This is Speaking of Shakespeare, conversations about things Shakespearean. I'm Thomas Dabbs, broadcasting from Aoyama Gakuin University in central Tokyo. If you're joining us on YouTube and wish to listen to this program as a podcast, you may click the link below to your favorite podcast platform. This talk is with Alec Ryrie, professor in the Department of Theology and Religion, Durham University, Gresham Professor of Divinity, and Fellow of the British Academy. Alec is a historian of Protestant Christianity in general and of religion in early modern England and Scotland in particular. His well-received and most recent book is entitled Unbelievers, An Emotional History of Doubt. Also not to be missed are his engaging YouTube lectures on various religious topics, which have garnered tens of thousands of views. We've asked him onto this series to explore religion in Shakespeare and theater of the period, and perhaps to show in a small way how religious worship and practice is inextricably intermixed with secular art and entertainment. This series is funded with institutional support from Aoyama Gakuin University and also with a generous grant from the Japan Society for the Promotion of Science. Welcome, Alec, and thank you so much. We are delighted to have you on our program.
It's a great pleasure to be with you, only sorry I can't be with you in person.
Well, now we've brought in an expert on the history of the English Reformation to a Shakespeare program. And some of our viewers may wonder what the Reformation has to do with Shakespeare. Even our modern readings of Shakespeare cannot be separated from the concurrent religious uncertainty and turmoil of the period in which Shakespeare and other major literary figures created their works. So in my opinion, religious reform has everything to do with Shakespeare, or if not everything, a lot. And I think you might agree with me. There are, by my estimate, countless points of departure for this type of discussion. But shall we begin with a famous ghost in Hamlet and with Purgatory? In the context of your recent book on unbelievers and other work that you've done, may I ask you what might have been some possible emotional responses to the appearance on stage of a ghost trapped in Purgatory in roughly the year 1600?
It's a great question, and it's such a kind of vivid moment, even in modern theatre, but much more so, I think, in late Elizabethan England, a country where the doctrine of purgatory has been outlawed, has been denounced as a Romish error for more than 40 years by that point. And of course, this is a play set in a Protestant country, in Lutheran Denmark, and the traces of the Lutheran Reformation are threaded right through Hamlet's story. You know, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern's trip to Wittenberg, and so the appearance of this ghost claiming that this is Hamlet's father in purgatory. As Catholics taught, suffering for to purge his sins before he can ultimately be admitted to heaven. Protestants deny that any of this is true. So you asked, what's the emotional response? It's going to be shock. Shock that a play should be daring to make this allegation, but it's not necessarily meaning that the play is a piece of advocacy for Catholic doctrine, because what a great many viewers would have assumed when they saw this account of the ghost, and you know, ghosts are a pretty regular a phenomenon throughout Europe at this period. People are accustomed to the idea that there are ghosts, but they also know what Protestant theologians teach about ghosts, which is that these are illusions, that these are malicious phantasms sent by the devil to tempt and deceive you. So the one of the first questions that they would be asking, and you can see this reflected in the text of the play itself, is this spirit telling us the truth? Is this really Hamlet's father? Or is it a demonic figure sent to tempt him towards murder by telling him lies? And that is what a good Protestant would presume that it is, there's no such thing as purgatory, there's no such thing as ghosts from purgatory. So the fact that a ghost should appear and be telling these lies both about about doctrines and the shape of the world, and also about Hamlet's own family history and the crimes that he's trying to entice Hamlet into, would absolutely fit with that. That's a reading that doesn't seem as intuitively obvious to us nowadays as it would to many in that audience. But because, I mean, Hamlet is such it's so much the play of doubt and uncertainty, isn't it? Yeah. And that element of confusion, of being unclear what to do with this claim, you know, Shakespeare is really pulling at a thread in English religious life at that time by doing this. I think these doubts and questions about what really happens to the dead are ones that have been going back right through the Middle Ages, and beyond, of course. We can trace that through a whole series of medieval sources. But the Reformation crisis that had blown up a lifetime before Hamlet was written has really brought these questions to the fore. There are radically different claims about what death means, what the human soul is, and what the post-mortem experience, if any, might be, that are being made by the different religious parties. And one of the things this play does is to stir up those uncertainties, to inflame that sense of doubt. No better way than doing it by putting a ghost who may not be a ghost at the middle, talking about purgatory which may not exist.
Yeah. Well, as you and other historians of the period have pointed out over and over, the curtain didn't just drop. You didn't just one day say, okay, there's no more purgatory, and everybody goes, okay. And there would be people maybe within living memory who, certainly their parents, certainly as they were brought up, their parents would have been living during the Marian period. They may have had grandparents who remember the whole bit, you know, starting with Henry VIII. And this thing is still unsettled about the afterlife. And of course, Horatio, before the ghost appears, talks about, he makes reference to Plutarch and Julius Caesar and the sheeted dead who ran through the streets before Caesar was assassinated. And the play, and then later in the fifth act, we get Bones. And I'm kind of interested, I don't want to get too much into the weeds, but there's the theology of purgatory, the cosmic theology of purgatory. But there was real destruction that you go into in several places in your work during the Edwardian period, in particular, where, of course, Henry, I think, and you can correct me because I'm not an expert, but Henry, you think of the monasteries, the abbeys, that period. But when Edward came in, they went after the chantries, and those were the places where you prayed for the dead souls of your loved ones, if I'm right. And those were the places that endured destruction, kind of, as you said, mass destruction during that period. And I'm thinking in particular in parish churches in London and also St. Paul's Cathedral.
Yes, that's absolutely right. Although I don't think we should forget how important the dissolution of the monasteries is to this as well.
Okay.
So this really is a two stage, it's a multi stage process, but those are the two biggest steps in it. The monasteries, the religious houses of late medieval Europe, especially in Northern Europe and in the British Isles and elsewhere, have become institutions whose main purpose is prayer for the dead, prayer for their founders and benefactors, but also for the whole of the Christian community. They've been described as great factories producing prayer for the dead. This whole industry centered around this. An enormous amount of the resources of the late medieval church, of late medieval Christendom, are being plowed into intercession for the dead, whether that's through prayer, through masses, pilgrimage, good works of all kinds are often seen as you give to the poor so that they will pray for your soul and for the souls of others. The difference between what's happening in the monasteries and what's happening in the chantries and parish churches is that in general, chantries are founded to pray for the souls of particular individuals or particular families. The monasteries have a responsibility to pray for the souls of all Christians. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So they're a universal phenomenon, which means that when Henry VIII wipes out English monasticism in the years between 1536 and 1540, without ever declaring that that's his policy aim, he just does it. That has an enormous knock-on but undeclared effect on the doctrine of purgatory. It is easy to conclude, lots of people at the time do conclude, surely this means that Henry VIII is denying the doctrine of purgatory. That he's at the very least he's clearly treating it with contempt as something that doesn't matter. There are those who try to stand up in pulpits afterwards and say, well, now clearly we have denied purgatory, and then they get slapped down. But the formal statement of the English Church's doctrine that Henry produces in 1543, the so-called King's Book, has a very peculiar passage at the end about purgatory, where it says it effectively throws up its hands and says, we don't know anything about this. It may well be that there's a purgatory, but we are ignorant on the subject.
We don't know where your loved ones are. If you're if you're a yeoman farmer or a freeman of a trade guild in London, and you knew that the bones of your loved ones were somewhere, maybe in Paul's Cross in the churchyard there, right? And then suddenly the entire charnel chapel where they preserved the bones is destroyed, and the bones moved to an undisclosed location somewhere north of town. I'm thinking personally, Alec, my parents passed away in 2005, but I know where they are. We do things a little differently now than they did then. But you have an entire city filled with people, parish churches and the big cathedral and all over England, where now this whole idea of preserving the bones of the dead, I think, became part of the idea of worshiping holy relics in a suspiciously Roman way. And there was just no more care institutionally, but the people whose loved ones, they felt they knew where they were suddenly just stripped away. And now where are they? What's going to happen?
You're absolutely right. There's a theological set of questions about what happens to the soul after death. But what happens to the body, to the mortal remains, is supposed to be made
new again. Your body is made new again.
Exactly. I mean, these people stand up and declare in church week by week that they believe in the resurrection of the body, and therefore the mortal remains matter. This is one of the reasons why heretics are burnt at the stake. The destruction of the body, the reduction of it to ashes, is a powerful statement. Now, of course, if you ask a theologian, they will say, God is almighty; he can reconstitute a body that's been scattered to the winds. If you die in a fire, that doesn't mean you won't be raised. But the visceral impact that this has, and the importance that's attached to mortal remains is hugely important. And this helps to feed into these doubts that I was talking about what happens post-mortem to souls. If you have this importance that's attached both in popular thought and theologically to bodies, then, you know, a dead body does look awful dead. There's a doubt widely raised in the first generation of the Reformation, which then is suppressed, but keeps bubbling up thereafter, of what happens to souls between death and the resurrection, the resurrection at the day of judgment. The orthodox doctrines of purgatory, the old doctrine of purgatory, no longer apply for Protestants. And so some begin to say, well, perhaps souls simply sleep in the grave before being raised with their bodies. Now, theologically, that's very difficult. But this knotty problem of not just where are my parents' bodies now, which, you know, with a little bit of luck, you can go and visit their tomb, but where are their souls now? Are they in heaven? Are they waiting somewhere, which sounds awfully like purgatory? Are they asleep? Are they even, and some people begin to say this a little bit after Shakespeare's time, are they dead? Have their souls died with the body and will then be raised with the body at the last day? Nobody has entirely certain and convincing answers to these questions in the Protestant world. Plenty of people claim that they do, but the nature of all these doubts is that it's much easier to ask questions than to answer them, and people can proclaim certain solutions to these problems, but that doesn't mean that they can close down or settle these discussions once for all. And so I think one of the characteristics of this period is that a set of doubts and questions have been unleashed, which are gnawing away at the religious certainties that this culture still feels should define it.
Yeah, it is the undiscovered country there. And I'm thinking, yes. I'm thinking of also of Richard II. Of course, you had the excuse that this is a historic play when England was the Roman Catholic, when it was part of the Roman Church and under the Pope, and Henry praying before the Battle of Agincourt, and he's worried. And he wants to remind God that even though his father had usurped the throne, that he has put out a whole legion of nuns to pray for the soul of Richard, who was his father was the beneficiary, and Richard, of course, was killed. But he still is feeling that guilt, like it may carry over. And I think that would be another highly dramatic moment, you know, that you could that would be a thought that would come in the head of an English king before battle. And then you have at the end of Hamlet this thing that happened, is in my reading, after a big rain, sometimes those people, you know, buried kind of mass burials during the plague or whatnot, those bones came back up. And so there's that question as you're walking to work in the morning, as you may be walking to a playhouse, see a play or going to church or whatnot, going to a worship. Those things just seem to pop up, not just in Hamlet. Oh, the tempest, the idea of burial at sea, you know, that fearful thought. And that's then and now, you know, what happens. And I just see this now that I look in the context of how these people in such a short period of time, you know, had to adjust, and how perfect that is for a dramatic questioning of this. I think that if we put our heads together, we could think of countless more in Shakespeare, other dramatists of this question that is enduring. We still have it now, you know, any child who goes to church, you know, this one included, had that question, and there's no answer. And so there it is in Hamlet. Now in Japan, when we get to this ghost in purgatory, I have to stop and explain and go into this whole idea of what is the Catholic, what is the Protestant. And I'm not even sure what the average current Catholic, Roman Catholic, really thinks about this. I've asked, and I've gotten some vague responses, and then they've asked me, and I've, you know, returned some vague. So these are enduring questions. They're still dramatic, but in a Japanese context, they're not, you know, the joke that I tell in my class is these are people who are raised in a Shinto Buddhist tradition, but basically they're Japanese. They're not that, they will all say, not all, but many will say that they're just not religious at all. I'll ask a class of maybe 100 people or whatnot, how many of you believe there is an afterlife? And there'll be some who say yes. And about half of them will say, nah, you're just dead when you're dead. All right. And I said, okay, well, I want you to go to nearby Aoyama Cemetery with me. There's an enormous cemetery near our school, and meet me at 12 o'clock tonight. And they don't want to have anything to do. So, you know, when put to the test, unbelief doesn't hold up any better than belief does sometimes. Right. So
there's a famous sermon, preached by John Donne, sort of near contemporary of Shakespeare's, of course, where he is preaching against what he calls atheism, and I mean, if you like, we could talk about what that means, which he sees as unbelief. He sees as something that people boast about in taverns, that they like to show off how fearless they are and how much they're willing to scoff at any notion of faith, because it makes them look tough in that sort of setting.
Very often the young men are the most strident. Now you have a lecture on this, and let's segue into atheism here.
The point about Donne, just sort of paralleling what your students are saying, he challenges his audience. You know, you may boast that you're an atheist in the tavern when surrounded with your friends, but do you dare say it when you lie on your bed in the middle of the night alone? He assumes that when they are alone with their consciences, alone with God, that none of them would quite have the nerve to do so under those circumstances. So yeah, these things, you know, roll on down the centuries.
David Riggs some years ago wrote about this, and you have talked about this recently and thrown it into the context of Tournier, the atheist tragedy, which your evaluation is that it's not the best play written during the period, and I think that might be a general feeling. And also Marlowe, of course, Marlowe. These are your examples. And Marlowe in particular, he had some really ugly, he was recorded to have said some really almost, you kind of think of a sort of punk rock, a rough sort of street language about just going at hitting every pressure point, you know, in terms of being irreverent.
I mean, when obviously we have all these, you know, extraordinary inflammatory claims that are attributed to Marlowe, that, you know, these accusations, most of them made in the last few months, some of them in the last few days of his life. And, you know, Marlowe's personal history and the circumstances of his death are all, you know, deeply mysterious. I am not a conspiracy theorist, but I think it is reasonable to suspect there was a little more going on in his death than the inquest allowed. I think the problem that many scholars and historians have had when trying to interpret Marlowe's statements and his supposed atheism, I think you can use that word about it, is that we're trying to establish, you know, what's the intellectual rationale or genealogy behind him, you know, what are the different strands of thought that he's drawing on and piecing together here. And the trouble is his ideas are, as recorded in these problematic documents, are chaotic and openly self-contradictory in places. But I think if we stop looking at the intellectual or philosophical rationale for what he's doing and start listening to the emotion that's at work in them, we get further. Because the emotion that I think drives through all of these statements is fury. Marlowe's rage at the church, its false morality, its milk and water restraints on what human beings like himself really want to and are driven to do, the hypocrisy that he sees threaded through it at every stage. I think if we read those statements less as a policy position, one of Marlowe's accusers said that he read the atheist lecture. That claim is made about him as if he was advancing a position paper. I don't think he was reading a lecture. I think he was issuing a howl of rage. And if we can hear that, if we can hear that sense of fury, of shaking your fist at the moon, that's driving him, I think we can come much closer to understanding. And okay, I would want to be very, very careful about identifying Marlowe or any Elizabethan Jacobean playwright with any one of their characters. I mean, the nature of the stage play as a genre is that you never hear the author's voice. You hear the voices of a series of characters and the author steps in and out of them without ever being identified with any one of them, which if you are trying to conceal your own beliefs or at least be discreet about them, makes it a very attractive art form. Even so, I think it's hard to read the character of Faustus without at least seeing a sliver of Marlowe or somebody who is in dialogue with Marlowe, someone who part of him would like to be. This character who talks of his hunger for knowledge but dismisses all the existing sciences as rubbish and contemptible, and yet who has this very peculiar relationship with Mephistopheles, a character who explicitly makes a deal with the devil while also denying that he believes that there is a devil or that there is a hell. And also, of course, Marlowe then writes the lines from Mephistopheles too.
That's right.
Who is able to reply. I'm forgetting the exact couplet. You'll have it in your head, I'm sure. Where Faustus says, "Come now, I think hell's a fable," and Mephistopheles says, "Yes, think you think that until you're here."
That's right. And we're not out of hell where we stand, basically.
Which is a profound theological point that Mephistopheles makes.
Yes,
for a demon, there is no escaping hell.
Yes,
that hell is in their nature because they are they're deprived of the beatific vision.
Yes,
they're cut off from the source of all creation.
Yes, Milton picks up on that too, and Satan.
Yeah.
You know, I wish I could just recall the lines, but it's just extraordinary. But you know, wherever he goes, hell he brings. You know.
It's exactly the same thing. So yeah. I don't think you can see Marlowe as an atheist in the sort of strict modern sense of the word, as somebody who has signed up to a clear, well-defined philosophy in which there is no God.
Yeah.
He's somebody who is reaching for that. I mean, you don't really have the philosophical structures to allow people to reach that sort of settled position in an intellectually sophisticated way in Europe until the other end of the 17th century. Spinoza is the great watershed there, I think. Widely recognized. Although there's, you know, a lot of these people are reading, you know, Lucretius and, you know, other ancient sources, which allow them to, you know, begin to move in that sort of direction. Because some of the philosophical tools are there. But even before you have the fully worked out philosophies, the emotional underpinnings of this kind of doubt are thoroughly in place. Whether it's the sort of anger that you see in Marlowe and Faustus, or whether it's the kind of gnawing skepticism that you see in Hamlet, who's sort of entangled by doubts that he himself can't fully control.
Yeah, but this is the salient point at the beginning of your book on unbelievers and unbelief, that, and I just didn't see it before I read it in your book, that the Reformations that were coming around are, and this, what you called again, weapon of mass destruction. And I was thinking, well, that's a nice image. Now I'm going, wait a second. A lot of things were destroyed. It was, you know, sure. I mean, physical things were destroyed. And this, this image of Passover came to my mind, you know, just from, you know, the Exodus. And, and I'm thinking, here you have it. You break with Rome, and when you do that, you're doing it on the basis of doubt, of unbelief in the principles of a longstanding church. So you're using doubt as a weapon to reestablish, but then the genie's out of the bottle. You know, you want your church, you know, your Anglican church, and yet the next guy can say, no, we don't think you should be baptized until you're an adult. And then another group pops up, and another group pops up. And then you have these universities out there who have these brilliant young students who might not want to go into the ministry or administration, like Marlowe, who say, okay, let's take it a step further. Let's just take this whole thing. It almost seems like a series of dominoes. A playwright, a clever, genius playwright like Marlowe would just say, I can put this on the stage and we can shake things up. And people are going to get scared, and they're also going to love it, you know.
The Reformation is a movement, and actually I think this goes back further deep into the Renaissance as well, is much better at asking questions than it is at answering them. It knows how to raise doubts and problems and illuminate difficulties, but it doesn't have a way of settling, of bringing these debates to an end and restoring people to a certain faith. Now, I mean, we mustn't get this out of proportion. It's not as if, you know, Luther stands up and says, you know, here I stand, which he didn't say obviously, but anyway, and instantly, you know, Europe collapses into chaos and doubt. But what Martin Luther's movement and the ones that follow it do is try to mobilize a wide constituency, a population-wide constituency, against certain teachings and practices of their established religion. And one of the key ways they try to do that is by weaponizing skepticism. They take a doctrine like, for example, the doctrine of transubstantiation, you know, the doctrine that every time a duly ordained priest says mass, that the bread and wine on the altar in front of him are miraculously but undetectably transformed into the actual physical human body and blood of Jesus Christ, which is a profound doctrine and a deep mystery, but it is also something that does strain credulity. And it's something that had strained credulity for centuries. And you will find Catholic theologians and preachers right through the Middle Ages talking about how difficult this is to believe, and you know, weaving whole pieties around the fact that it's difficult to believe. But now the Protestants are turning around and mocking it, not simply trying to develop theological arguments against it, but laughing at it, saying this is ridiculous, treating it with scorn and with contempt, which from their point of view makes absolute sense. They find this doctrine not just to be an error, but a shocking blasphemy, because it means that a piece of bread is being worshipped as if it were God. This is, from a Protestant point of view, the most outrageous idolatry. And yet, what they're doing by encouraging whole populations to mock, to despise the core of what had been their religion, the central rite of their religion for as long as anybody can remember, is inculcating that use of skepticism as a weapon. In effect, we talked about sort of weapons of mass destruction. They're conscripting the whole population to fight their war and distributing weapons to them. And once you have distributed weapons to people, you can't control what they do with. And the number of most of them very obediently do what they're told and obey what their new church leaders tell them to do, and then once the war is over, return their weapons to the state approved arsenal and go about their way. But some of them sew them under the mattress and keep them to run their own shows on the side. And so there is a real sense in which the moment the Protestants are openly challenging not just the particular teachings of the church, but the idea that the church can have authority, the idea that it can define doctrine authoritatively and definitively for the whole of Christendom, they are starting a process which it's impossible to finish. Their Catholic opponents instantly spot this. At the Diet of Worms, the first great confrontation between Luther and his opponents, his Catholic opponents are saying to him, "But if you do this, then we will never be able to settle any questions ever again. We will never be able to agree on anything," which, of course, is absolutely
correct. It's absolutely what happened.
This is the process which is, by the time Shakespeare is writing, has been underway for nearly a century, and is really starting to get going.
Yeah, well, I mean, while you're making these points, I'm thinking of Shakespearean parallels. And you make the point, and I quite agree with it, is that Shakespeare is very careful. He was very careful. He wasn't a Marlowe in terms of getting out there and just, this transgressive rhetoric. However, okay, yes, Romeo and Juliet is in Verona and they are Catholic there. So when they fall in love, they fall straight into a religious, you know, you are my shrine. Mm. I can touch you. And by touching you, I can get rid of my sin, giving my sin back again, going straight into this sort of orthodox.
Although Juliet also calls Romeo the god of her idolatry.
The god of her idolatry, which is, I think, would get under the skin of anybody from either side, right? Because mm-hmm. there's only one there. And so, and these things are scattered throughout Shakespeare, as are the, you mentioned also, escaped my mind here, but weaponry and how volatile, again in Romeo and Juliet, but in other places, certainly in Hamlet, how easy it is to stir up the masses when things are just slightly off kilter, right? And what the prince says, out of airy nothing, you know, here comes this anger. And Romeo said, out of nothing, you know, love, what are these things? They speak to religious belief that you are going into airy nothing and trying to give it shape and a way of worship.
I mean, you know, if it seems to me that if Shakespeare has one really consistent political view, it's fear of the mob. You know, the sense of what can happen when you arm the whole population in that way, and a sense of how close it is, of how easy it is for your society, whether it's modern Verona or ancient Rome or medieval England, to collapse into that kind of chaos.
Well, there were riots. There were plenty of riots. I've looked into these, and you know, it's between like the porters at these schools, say at the ends of court, who, of course, they're affiliated with these higher level people and they get officious. And these tradesmen, there seem to have been some kind of hostility. They're almost like two different football teams. You know, there's a sort of hooliganism that develops around. And so you have these things that are just in quotidian life that are these conflicts that it's a tinderbox, isn't it? Particularly in London. Well, I'm interested in moving on a little bit to the church rights. Sure. I wanted to ask you, and this is selfish of me, but it seems to me that Shakespeare very much avoids, and I think you have to, if you look closely at Romeo and Juliet, of course, in the Zeffirelli film, they're married, or you know, the priest does something in the film. But I don't think he could do that in a Shakespearean stage. I don't think you can actually do a church rite. And the burial in Hamlet is maimed. It isn't a proper burial, and nobody reads from the Book of Common Prayer. I think that was a good way to get thrown into the Marshalsea or someplace if you're one of these playwrights, right?
Yeah, no, that would be illegal.
You just could not do it, and you couldn't. Yeah. You certainly couldn't baptize anyone on stage or marry someone on stage. All right, well, that's the point. Is what's not in Shakespeare shows the influence of the church there.
I mean, it shows the influence of the church. It shows the influence of the law. In some ways, the Elizabethan Jacobean stage is remarkably free, and you know, the ability to put on a play like Richard II, which is is really inflammatory.
Essex got him to play it, right?
In
that kind indeed. Of Bay of Pigs he attempted.
That's good. Yeah. But there are certain rules, things that you can't do. I mean, you couldn't portray a rite of the established church on stage. And in some ways, for quite a straightforward reason, that if you baptized somebody on the stage, you know, is that a real baptism? You know, if somebody has said the words.
Yes.
And gone through the rite, you know, so you can't do something which might raise real legal questions about the validity or not of
they're act. Married, and in this case it would be a gay marriage.
It would be very awkward if you had to actually get the two young people married to each other every time you did it, especially since they're both men. But for the same reason that until the mid 20th century, it was illegal to portray the reigning monarch on stage.
I didn't know that.
One of the reasons why Shakespeare is filling, and not just Shakespeare, but the playwrights of his age are filling their stages with these historical monarchs, is because they're orbiting around a gap at the center that they cannot touch.
Yes.
You can put any of her predecessors on stage. Although, I mean, I think this is one of the reasons why Henry VIII is in my view, not a particularly great play, because the opportunities that he as a character might offer, which you could imagine under different circumstances Shakespeare leaping at, it's too explosive. You can't really do anything with this man because he's the queen's father.
Right.
And you would be coming just too close. So, of course, it's a late play, isn't it? But even so.
Yeah. But still, the memory is there. Well, I think I want to get to one point before we have to close out here.
Sure.
Again, a selfish point. But it has to do with as a Shakespearean or whatnot, having gone through that regimen of learning Shakespeare, there over and over again, you hear about the Puritan responses to the theater, you go, well, wait a second, there's a canon of statements that will come out from various preachers, and you go, you can't call these guys, like Stephen Gosson is a good example. He's not a Puritan. He's a divine in the Church of England. And he tries out theater. He wants theater to be moral, and he can't apparently get people to enjoy his moral theater. And some people make fun of him, and he fails, and he gets upset and writes a few things, thankfully, because it gives us some history. And then I think that we are pretty sure that he went off sort of Robert Herrick style to a parish church and lived a good life. He found his way there. But I really am looking at the publication history. It's no time to go into this, but the apparatus that the church used to spread the word from Paul's Cross and other pulpits, when you weren't doing the set service, according to the Book of Common Prayer, the preaching that was very often entrepreneurial, bouncing off in Paul's Cross, bouncing off these bookstores, they echo it. And the bookstores, they're selling text where the audience, for I think the first time in English history, actually could read before. They had reading knowledge of what the preacher was saying, many of them. And if they didn't, they could go back and go to get the book and read it. And so there's that exchange. And I think these early playwrights before Shakespeare and Shakespeare just said, we can do this too, right? And in some ways, the religious publishing industry gave way to a lot of secular texts that people had extra funds to invest in printing some of these texts that the playwrights used. And in some ways, the Reformed religion fed the stage in a very materialistic, basic way of providing a kind of economy for playwrights. And I just think that I think that's
clearly true. And I think in several different ways. In terms of just building up a print industry.
Yes.
The Reformation is a crucial accelerant of the spread of print. Protestantism in particular ties itself to the notion of the printed word, and the importance of literacy for post-Reformation England is hard to overemphasize. And this is a religious culture that really struggles to imagine what an illiterate Christianity might be like. You know, almost the only advice that Protestant preachers have for those who can't read is, well, go and learn to read. You know, they never quite say it's impossible to be a proper Christian or that it's impossible to be saved if you can't read. But they will explicitly say, if you have had the opportunity to read and you have not taken it, to learn to read and you have not taken it, then that is your fault and you are spiritually culpable.
Yeah. And if you can read the Bible, you can read Painter's Palace of Pleasure and any absolutely. Number of pleasure reading texts that these playwrights.
So I mean, the spread of literacy is you know, Protestantism is a huge accelerant to that. Now, of course, you don't need to be literate to attend a play or to enjoy it. But one of the other things that the Protestants are doing, as you say, is putting a huge new emphasis on preaching. You know, the preaching used to be, the rule pre-Reformation was that each parish should have a sermon four times a year. And sometimes that was delivered, sometimes it wasn't. More in the cities, less in the countryside. The Protestant aspiration is for every parish to have a resident preaching minister who might preach twice, three times a week. And we might not think of sermons as particularly entertaining, and some of them weren't, but these preachers were aware of the performative nature of what they were doing and of the pulpit as a stage.
Yes, and two turns of the glass, right? So
exactly.
It's about the same length of time as a play.
Yeah, I mean, two turns might, an hour is the sort of conventional standard for preaching, and more, some would aspire to longer. But they know that, to preach even for an hour, if you drone, then you're going to have lost people within 5 minutes. And there is a lot of attention given, especially by the Puritans, to this question of how you hold an audience's attention. And the passion, the directness, the clarity that they associate with their preaching. We should think of this less as a kind of a droning lecture and more of a sort of one-man show. Yeah. There's a description of the great Puritan preacher Richard Greenham outside Cambridge, who trained a whole generation of Puritan divines. Coming to the end of his sermons, hoarse and drenched in sweat. Yes. That these are whole body performances and have this kind of electrifying intensity. And he also talks about in one of these sermons, we have an account of a woman suddenly standing up and howling and running out of the church because she's been that convicted of her sin. Now, I mean, that's a response that any playwright would kill for.
Oh yes, But I mean, the spirit is entering into the preacher. He is full of, and that's the word of God coming through. He's the mouthpiece for
absolutely. And they the Puritans particularly described preaching as prophesying. That they're embodying God's word in that way. So if there's an antagonism between Puritan preachers and the English Renaissance stage, to some extent it's a sort of professional rival.
These are two
groups of performers in an arms race with one another to attract the attention of the same audience.
And disposable income, and that is still out there now. I grew up in a state in the U.S. where they closed all the bars at 12 o'clock on Saturday night. And you know precisely why, there was no, because everybody had to go home and to try to get as many of them to church as possible. But
in
this
as
whole,
ever as safe as possible. Yeah.
But you know, being filled with the Spirit, when you see a great, one of those great Shakespearean actors, you know, in the RSC when I was studying in London and whatnot, when you see them go into character, it is a kind of spiritual thing that happens there. And the similarity, and I'm certain these preachers, the better ones, I think Latimer had something because he's readable. I mean, you know, I read him and laugh, you know, whereas John Jewell's a little hard on the, and he's not the worst at all, John Jewell, but Latimer.
Latimer, well, Latimer is a man who could start a religious riot by opening his mouth.
Yes.
You know, it's clearly the most electrifying preacher of his generation. Yeah. There's an account of him preaching it at Exeter Cathedral in Devon. To an open air congregation, too many to get into the church, and you know, the heavens open, one of those seven sudden summer downpours that they get in there, and nobody moves. Wow. You know, they all stand and listen to him, and he gets more and more worked up, and he has a nosebleed in the congregation, you know, in the moment of the sermon, you can, you know, the sense of how worked up he's being. Doesn't lose his stride, just kind of holds something over his nose and carries on, you know, holding these people in the palm of his hand.
I guess just like you had to.
That's not theater. I don't know what is.
Well, you know, yes, I'm just thinking of the open air, the amphitheaters of the Globe, and the theater, and so forth. And when it rained, if you were that down, you know, among the groundlings, were you going to stay or not? And I imagine you had to find ways to keep people in the playhouse. Well, we're coming close. I know that you have an appointment you have to get to, and Alec, I could go on this subject. Speaking about two turns of the glass, I could do more, and I'm sure you could too. It is just a joy. I have I was introduced to you with your originally really with your YouTube lectures that have been out there for now a few years with the Gresham mm-hmm. College, and then that led me into reading more of your work. And it's just absolutely you've been so exquisitely productive over the past 20 years and more. But there's I can't cover all of this, but I want our viewers to know that this is just something extraordinarily good. And with lectures on YouTube, you know, you have a pause button, right? And you can listen while you're cooking, while you're working out or doing something, you know, and it's become such a wonderful way. I think much better than standing in the rain in the 16th century, you know. I told my wife, I said, you know, if this guy Alec had just spoken at my church when I was a kid, I would have listened and gotten so much more. Our preacher, dear soul that he was, he just didn't have it, you know. I had trouble following him as an 8-year-old boy, but anyhow, we're going to see you again soon.
That's
and
right.
I think this will get out maybe before your talk at our university on Protestantism in Asia, and we have some very enthusiastic people here. We're a Methodist university, and we don't have exactly a department of theology. Those were sort of cut out after the Tokyo riots in the 60s. The theologians were on the side of the students. That's another history. But, so, you know, the practical way to is just to get rid of that. But anyway, we have a strong committee of people who are Methodist and very attached to the foundational mission, the religious mission of this school, and they are very eager to hear you speak. And so we'll be able to meet again. And I'll let you get on with your day because I know you have to go. Alec, thank you so very much for joining.
Great pleasure talking to you, Tom. Have a good evening.